segregation policy. It's an apartheid policy, writ large, of course, in Israel-Palestine, where you have physical structures like the wall and checkpoints and gates and roads upon which Palestinians can't travel and only Jews can travel. You have the structures of apartheid and segregation and isolation and ghettoization that also occurred in for the Rohingya on a smaller scale, but nonetheless a very powerful scale. And once people are ghettoized, once they're segregated, once they're removed from their former neighbors, then it's much easier to annihilate them. And you can annihilate people in various ways. You can forcibly expel them. You can kill them. You can, as it was occurred with the Rohingya, engage in mass rape so that the babies born will be part Burmese and part Rohingya in 9 months' time. So there are various ways and force people to leave. You can, various ways you can annihilate a population. But then you talked about a later stage, and this is what symbolic enactment is, the term that Daniel Feirstein uses, but it embodies denial. It embodies the perpetrator state denies what's happened in various levels of denial, and then it basically reclaims the land as its own. So it erases the very history and existence of those who lived there before. And of course, we've got the Jewish National Fund. Most Jewish people I know grew up as kids with a box on their mantelpiece where they put money in to reforest or to forest Palestine, Israel. Right? And over the bodies of dead Palestinians and the ruins of their villages. Similarly, in Myanmar, there's a very similar process that over the destroyed Rohingya villages that took place in 2016-17, we now have state security facilities. Mosques are replaced by Buddhist temples. And so this whole idea of airbrushing the Palestinians or the Rohingya from the history of the perpetrator state plays a very crucial role in the genocidal process and has to be resisted. Of course, Myanmar and Israel were great friends and have an educational agreement where they can monitor the way in which their narratives are presented in the other country's school textbooks. And if they don't like what's being said, then they can alter them so that it makes sure that the Burmese are going to get the Israeli narrative and not the Palestinian narrative about the genocide and vice versa. But I think there's another stage after symbolic enactment, and that I think relates to the humanitarian camp. And that's work I'm currently doing at the moment. But I think that what we're seeing in humanitarian camps in Bangladesh for the Rohingya, we have 1.2 million Rohingya languishing in Bangladesh camps. And there are about 140,000 Rohingya encamped inside Myanmar. And what we see in those camps is that, if you like, a reproduction of the genocidal processes. First of all, of course, they are contained. They're still segregated. They're denied citizenship. Their calorific count is reduced whenever the World Food Program has cuts to its own budget. There's a political vacuum inside these camps, which allows organized crime to develop and violence against civil society leaders again to develop. And so I think what we are seeing is a systematic weakening of people in these camp situations, fostered by humanitarianism, sadly. In Gaza and in Palestine generally, we have 7.5 million refugees throughout the world, Palestinian refugees, many, many of whom live in camps, still live in camps, decades and decades on. And what we've seen in Gaza was an enforced ghetto, the largest open-air prison in the world. And now we are seeing it exposed to the horrors of this annihilatory phase that I talked about. But I think that what we're going to see now in the humanitarian camps, we're already witnessing the the idea of humanitarian aid centres as being killing sites, slaughterhouses, when Palestinians attempt to get food from these Israeli-run sites, basically, that are supposedly fueled by humanitarians.
And one shudders to think what the children of Gaza, like half of Gaza's population, are children. And one shudders to think about, to contemplate what the lives of the children who, you know, physically survive the Israeli genocide are going to be like over the course of the years, and what their children's lives are going to be like if they indeed have children. And you've spoken about senescicide. You've talked about the use of disabling tactics by the Israeli military, creating a population which is profoundly weakened. It's malnourished. It's prone to illness. Disease is rampant, and it's being human development is being crushed. It's being stunted. Israel's creating a population of underdeveloped people, sick people, stunted people.
Yeah, and at the same time, they have destroyed any rehabilitative and health infrastructure that would normally step in and allow people to live fulfilled lives despite any form of disability.
Talk about senescicide.
Senescicide, yes. I think it's a term that Grace Spence Green and I came up with just to describe the wholesale assault on the healthcare system and the rehabilitative system inside Gaza. So that Israel used to have a policy of maiming, and that's where the policy was. You would injure Palestinians in 2018, the Great March of Return, that you would consciously aim to disable Palestinians. And so that pressure on the health services and the rehabilitative services would be so great as to weaken the whole society. Now, we know that Palestinians have the most extraordinary degree of resilience, and they will not be beaten, and the term Samud captures that beautifully. But nonetheless, I mean, and Israel has somewhat abandoned that approach because now it's just simply wholesale killing and the wholesale destruction of the entire infrastructure that supports the people of Gaza. So senescicide really does describe this. I've never seen anything like it in terms of my experience of studying genocides, where a regime, a perpetrating state, has consciously taken out the healthcare services, every single hospital in Gaza, every single rehabilitation service has been attacked and largely destroyed. So I think that the impact that will have is, as you say, absolutely profound on future generations, and certainly in terms of mental health. Every single Gazan has been impacted, both physically and in terms of their mental health. But you know, David, I mean, I'm thinking about the way in which Palestinians historically have demonstrated their capacity to fight back, to come back, to rebuild their societies. But I'm looking at those, you talk about Palestinian children, I'm looking at those Israeli children, the children that Israel sends on a boat, on a propaganda exercise, to try to head off the flotilla, the children who sing songs about killing Palestinians, joyfully singing songs, those children who have been somehow incorporated into this genocidal narrative, who will forever be tarred. I mean, what the Palestinians haven't lost their humanity, but the Israeli children and the Israelis have.
And this is one of the horrific things that I contemplate, Penny, when I think about this, and I think about the United States, Israel's dear, dear friend, the United States, and Canada and the UK, which just adores Israel. And I think, what a wonderful gift the Western powers, the European Union and the United States, are conferring upon Israel. What incredibly good friends. This is like, you know, somebody who sees their friend sinking into the depths of alcoholism, and they're really great friends, and they're always giving their friends, you know, 26-ounce bottles of whiskey. Like, what a great friend those people are. And I think this is the legacy that is being sown by the United States and the Western powers. And, I mean, if you're only focusing on Israel and thinking about the Jewish people, what a terrible thing to do to the Jewish people.
Yes, yes. And as I said, I think of those Jewish-Israeli children who will undoubtedly be impacted in a way that is really terrifying for their futures and terrifying for the future of the world, quite frankly. Whereas the Palestinian children, I mean, the starvation, the brutality that has been expended on those children, it's you know, we have more child amputees since October the 7th than any time in human history in terms of child amputees. The number of spinal cord injuries and so on. But there's something about the Palestinian spirit, and it's because they're right. Morally, they are right. They are defending their right to live in the land that was theirs. They weren't excluding anybody from the land of Palestine. And yet, you know, in 1948, we have Zionists, European Zionists, forcibly expelling Palestinians from their land. The Palestinians know that they stand on the right side of history and that the vast majority of the world supports them. Unfortunately, not our states, not our governments, but the vast majority of right-thinking people in the world are horrified by what Israel has done and by the support that the United Kingdom and the United States and European states and other states around the world have provided Israel. But Palestinians know that they are, that they will rise up, that they will ultimately win. And I think that that gives them, and in terms of the future of Palestinians and the possibility of a future where they live in Palestine, and Palestine is a state in which people of every creed, every color, every religion can live with equal human rights, is a real possibility. All the Palestinians I know, that's what they speak of. The idea of some kind of ethno-supremacist state is absolutely anathema to the Palestinian people. And so that's what gives me hope for the future of Palestinians. But I have very little hope for the future of these Jewish Israelis who have supported and engaged and been right behind, even if not necessarily behind Netanyahu, but behind the annihilation of the Palestinian people.
Bringing this conversation to a close, Penny Green, and thank you so much for your time. I'd like to get back to this contrast between civil society initiatives like that of the Gaza Tribunal and state-sponsored official bureaucratic institutions like the International Court of Justice. The ICJ has given Israel until January 2026 to file its counter memorial, its huge response to South Africa's charges against Israel under the Genocide Convention. The ICJ last April gave Israel until January 2026 to file its arguments. And we can assume that the ICJ's 15 justices will ponder that until maybe 2027 or 2028. I mean, the ICJ process is—it seems like it's not meaningless, but it's not a vessel within which to invest a lot of hope, in my view. And when it finally, if and when it finally issues a genocide ruling, it'll be ignored by the Western powers, I would reckon. Now, compare that. You can comment on all that. But meanwhile, there's the Gaza Tribunal, which is going to be holding its final hearings in Istanbul at the end of October. Tell me what's going to come out of that process, and where do you see the tribunal and the Gaza Declaration, the Sarajevo Declaration, and soon, I guess, it'll be an Istanbul Declaration. Where do you see that process going, and how are will the results compare and contrast with the results that are coming out of the ICJ? It's a big question.
It's a big question, but I think it's a very good question, because I think it speaks to the heart of the kind of work that those of us on the Gaza Tribunal engage in our academic lives and in our public lives. I think that you're absolutely right about the ICJ, that it is a very bureaucratic machine. It has, I think that South Africa's case was really majestic, and I applaud South Africa for bringing the case. But we have to be very realistic, and we have to understand the history of these courts. They have no enforcement power. They are also incredibly bureaucratic. They will take inordinately long periods to make a decision. Even the interim decision that there was a plausible case for genocide, and that Israel should do everything in its power to prevent genocide, is what it's already required to do. I mean, that interim ruling says nothing new. And it was the same ruling that the ICJ issued to the Myanmar state in relation to the Rohingya in 2019. And still we have no decision on the Rohingya case that was brought by the Gambia. And so I think one of the, you know, Palestine has exposed the gross inadequacies of the international legal order. And I think effectively we can expect very, very little from the international legal order, and we shouldn't be expecting, that's not where we should be looking for change. We should, as you say, be looking towards civil society. And the Gaza Tribunal is one example, as I mentioned a range of other examples of initiatives that have been taken by civil society. But the Gaza Tribunal has the legitimacy. I mean, civil society has a high degree of legitimacy as a force to monitor and attempt to control and challenge the crimes, as we would call them, of states. And I think the Gaza Tribunal has at its heart the idea to animate global civil society, to sort of be a sort of something of a spearhead. There's so much happening, but it's one part of what is happening around the world in order to challenge this genocide. We would, of course, at the base of all the activities that civil society is engaged in around the world at the moment is an attempt to prevent the genocide. Nobody has succeeded in that because of the way in which power is organized in our world. But I think that there have been some very big wins, particularly in terms of the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. And the Gaza Tribunal brings together representatives of Palestinian civil society, global civil society, public intellectuals, journalists, together as a kind of a force to lend further animation to the civil society enterprise, to say that this is where we have the most power in our society, this is where change can really be initiated, and the more that we coalesce, the more that we bring the these different organizations that are operating, you know, organizing, you know, Palestine Solidarity Committee, Stop the War Movement, the Flotilla Movement. We're going to have a march through Sinai from Cairo. These initiatives, along with the Gaza Tribunal, need to sort of, if you like, be pulled together in some kind of united front, I think. And I think that's one of the efforts of the Gaza Tribunal does that. It brings together people who are operating at different levels and in different roles in civil society to challenge the genocide. And I think the declaration is something that we can work with. You know, with the Sarajevo Declaration, we have a commitment to stand up against not only the egregious crimes of Israel, but the complicity and partnership that's offered by Western states. And we hope that it maintains the momentum, it encourages more momentum in relation to this fight, because it's only civil society, and certainly the international legal order has proven itself utterly incapable of delivering justice to groups like the Rohingya, to the Palestinians. And in fact, the international legal order and the United Nations, whilst there are some magnificent parts of the United Nations like UNRWA, the rest of it has basically serviced the impunity that has been afforded Israel. And it's really only civil society and supporting Palestinians in whatever way they wish to resist this genocide. That's how we are going to achieve change.
Penny Green is a professor of law and globalization at Queen Mary University, London, and founder, co-director of the International State Crime Initiative. She's also a member of the steering committee of the Gaza Tribunal. We'll link to the Gaza Tribunal and to Penny Green's work and publications and that of her colleagues at greenplanetmonitor.net. Penny Green, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure.
That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Shout out to CFM-UFM, McMaster University Radio. You can hear the GPM there, too. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM, talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role-playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
You are listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.